Hello, everybody. It is Wednesday in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My name is Adam Bittner, assistant sports editor for multimedia at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Back after a couple of weeks here with Seth Engel for a Penn State football podcast. Penn State begins spring practice this week. Seth was there when James Franklin spoke to the media. So, Seth, you're back from spring break, so now seems like a good time to catch up.
Yeah, no, I came back from Florida, and right away, you know, spring practice kicking off on Tuesday, and got to talk to James in the morning and checked out practice later that day. And then, you know, Friday we got pro day too. So it's a relatively busy week, and I'm just kind of looking forward to getting football back on the road. It feels like it just ended, but you know, here we are starting up again.
Yeah, Seth, let's dive into it. James Franklin made a lot of comments that I think we're going to react to. The one I found most noteworthy was about midway through his session with the media, where he talked about the receivers, and that's a topic you and I keep coming back to on this podcast. He said he doesn't think there is a talent problem at wide receiver for Penn State. He says all of the athletic testing numbers are there with, you know, some of the best teams in the country. That's why, you know, that was his explanation for why we didn't see them do much in the portal beyond Julian Fleming, a guy that they had, you know, quite a long relationship. What do you say on the point that he made about that? Is it conceivable that the way this passing game looked for so much of last season was a design of the offense type of thing, a Mike Yurcich problem? Because I'll be honest, I think it is both. I think that the talent, if you have talent, we've seen in the past how that can overcome even bad offensive coordinating, and we did not see that as much this past season. What's your read on the argument that he was making and how much validity it holds in your mind?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's also both. I mean, you look at the talent aspect, and it wasn't there. I mean, there's if you look at these talented wide receivers of years past that Penn State's had, you look at Jahan Dotson, you look at Chris Godwin, Allen Robinson, those guys pop out at you. You say, okay, well, these guys are crazy, like crazy talented. Even Parker Washington kind of showed some of those intangibles of this is a very good wide receiver, just genuinely. I just don't think Penn State had – you know, one of those guys last year. I mean, there are obviously other problems, like you mentioned, with play calling and, you know, maybe with position coaching too, to kind of rally that group. But, you know, talent has to be a problem. There's no way that talent was not, you know, a problem within that wide receiver room last year that contributed to the offensive struggles. And I do think that the way that Andy Kotelnicki kind of designs his offense, and maybe also explains the playbook to his players and maybe simplifies things, I think could have a potential impact, especially, you know, when you're bringing in a veteran guy like Julian Fleming too, who, I mean, this room also lacked a true leader. So to bring in a veteran guy like that, we've heard, you know, pretty rave reviews about so far. I think there could be, you know, a pretty good impact on the room as a whole.
I want to talk about the Andy Kotelnicki comments that he also made, because they seem to be at odds with the statement that, no, we don't have a talent problem at wide receiver. Yeah. Because in the next breath, he was talking about how he likes what Andy Kotelnicki do, because he's going to bring some play action in, and he's putting an emphasis on improving against man coverage. And to me, improving against man coverage is a talent problem, I think, yeah, at the base. And yes, the cliche we love to use in football these days is scheme guys open. And I think Andy Kotelnicki will be creative. I think he'll find ways to get guys open. But I think that is kind of a response to having less talent rather than the chicken or the egg type of scenario. I look at it and say, if you think you're deficient against man coverage, a statement that I would certainly agree with having watched Penn State last season, especially the games I saw in person where guys just simply weren't open, then doesn't that at some level come down to being a talent thing?
Yeah, no, it always comes back to that. But at the same time, you know, this was an offense that struggled so much last year that they had to fire their offensive coordinator midseason. So you do understand, you know, kind of how it goes both ways. But I do think that, you know, maybe that wide receiver room, you know, maybe learned something from this past season. And maybe the coaching staff learned something too, because I don't think James Franklin had wide receiver core and, you know, his whole coaching tenure that struggled as much as this group did last year. So moving forward under a new offensive system, you know, maybe something will change. But, you know, I think having talked to Kotel Nicki and, you know, seeing the way that he kind of runs his practices, you know, it's promising. It's promising for this offense for sure.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit. We mentioned Julian Fleming. I know you got to see a little bit of workouts on Tuesday. What did you see from him? What did you see at field level and how, you know, things were being run and your read on the early days of spring practice here, specifically at the receiver position?
Yeah, I mean, you can only see so much from, you know, the 10, 15 minutes that they allow us to get out there for. But to just see Julian Fleming in Penn State gear, you know, at the last practice facility, it's kind of surreal when you think about that whole storyline of, you know, him nearly coming to Penn State a few years ago as, you know, number one wide receiver in the country, goes to the rival Ohio State, and a few years later, you know, James Franklin finally gets his guy. So to see him actually practicing with James Franklin, kind of watching on the sidelines, was pretty interesting. And he's a big guy. You know, it's not like I saw too much of him. You know, they were kind of running some plays, but he's a big guy. I think he's a big wide receiver, but he also moved pretty well. And Kotel Nicki, you know, he struck me as just a guy with a ton of energy and, you know, some intensity. You know, I shot a video of him that I put on Twitter of this guy just like screaming at one of his players, which, you know, that's just coaching football. But to kind of see him in action outside of the press room, and you know, I think there's a lot to be excited about as Penn State, you know, moves into the spring here.
Good to hear that there's some energy going on up there. Seth, I know he also spoke about Drew Aller while we're on the passing game, and I think, you know, a lot of the conversation has to kind of begin with him. He talked a lot about, James Franklin did, about consistency, and how that's something that he seems to want to see more of from Drew Aller. And he was he alluded to the touchdown to interception ratio and how Drew Aller did a good job of avoiding costly mistakes last season. I think how many games into the season did he get without throwing a pick? That's something we talked about a lot. And then he said, but he still needs to be more consistent. And then it got a little word salad-y from there. I interpreted that, Seth, as, you know, part of being quarterback isn't just avoiding the mistakes, it's making plays. And I don't know how much of we saw from Drew Aller this season. What was your read on that response, you know, about what Aller has to do this season and what getting to the next level means for Drew?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that all last year where, you know, he obviously protected the football well, but there weren't too many games maybe outside of West Virginia that you said, oh, okay, well, this guy is really popping off. You know, I can only think of maybe a handful of plays throughout the season that I said, okay, well, you know, this guy's pretty talented. And I know that he has the ability to make certain throws and make things happen. He just didn't necessarily show that on a consistent basis, especially against some of those top teams, which Franklin also alluded to, when he said, you know, he needs to do it against all competition. When you look back at, you know, Ohio State and Michigan, you know, maybe his two worst games of the year, but also Penn State's two most important. You know, for him to be able to do what great quarterbacks do, I think that's basically what he was saying there, which is, you know, what you alluded to as well, is, you know, you got to be careful with the football. You don't want to, you know, give it away necessarily, but you got to make plays sometimes. And I think that just comes with growing up and, you know, being more of a veteran football player, and in Kotel Nicki's system, which is kind of free flowing and it's complex and creative. You know, I think that there is maybe a canvas for Drew to be able to do that more, you know, next fall.
How much of last season do you think was him being a little more overly cautious as he became the starter? Because I think back to 2022 and how he kind of just let the ball fly in those instances when he got in late in games. Yeah. Penn State had very little to lose. And that's where I think, saw a lot of that arm talent, for lack of a better term. You know, I think to that Ohio game that I saw in person, and he was making throws that made me say, wow. I think back to, you know, that game at Indiana, I believe they played in his freshman season, where he made some pretty cool throws. And then we just didn't see as much of that as a starter, as a sophomore. Do you think that he kind of played things more cautious, just because we did not see those throws that made you say, wow, nearly as often? I think of, there was one across the field at Illinois that sticks out in my mind, but there aren't a ton And especially the later you got in the season, the fewer of them there were.
Yeah, I mean, that throw, that was probably the best throw of the year at Illinois, the one that he hit Liam Clifford, you know, at the end of the first half there. But for him to be able to do that, because that's what I'm saying, is like he had flashes, right? I think West Virginia was his best game of the year, his only game that he threw over 300 passing yards. For him to be able to do that, I think that is the key to him kind of taking the next step. But I do think that there is a level of cautiousness that you take when you kind of just step in as the starting quarterback. And your first game, you know, you're playing in front of 110,000 people with playoff implications on your shoulders. You know, that's a lot of pressure. So I think that maybe this year, having had a full year of experience already under his belt, you know, he's got a new offense now. He's got his quarterback coach, you know, solidified. Like him and Danny O'Brien, I feel like that can't go, you know, stated enough. Is just him and Danny O'Brien have such a good relationship. For Danny to be his right-hand man now officially as quarterback's coach, I think is huge for his development. You know, also physically, Drew looks a little different than he did last year. He's a little leaner, which Franklin, you know, said yesterday, and we saw him at practice. You know, he looks a little slimmed down, but apparently he's still carrying that weight. You know, so maybe he's going to be able to do some things that we didn't even see that he was capable of doing last year.
Let's get into some Abdul Carter. I know James Franklin spoke about him and the transition to defensive end. He seems to be, you know, lowering expectations a little bit in terms of saying, listen, the transition from being a linebacker to a defensive end is probably similar to be the difference between being a linebacker and going to the secondary, and that this is maybe not going to be as seamless as some people think. What's your read on what Abdul Carter has to show this spring to kind of engender belief in this position switch?
Yeah, I think contrary to what maybe people assumed at first, that wasn't really a team decision. That was something, you know, Abdul wanted to do. I think primarily because of his weight. You know, at this point, like we saw when he came to school, he was probably hovering around like 220 and just took off. You know, he's at 250 right now, which is massive for a linebacker. And at that point, I think it's just easier for him to move when he's playing on the defensive line. So I think that kind of shift came from him. So this is something that he wanted. And I do think it's a good move, you know, and you look at him now and he's standing with the rest of the defensive line room. And he doesn't look any smaller. You know, he's one of those guys. He's one of the defensive ends now. You know, the question now kind of shifts to, okay, well, what are they going to do at linebacker now that he's kind of shifted positions? And we know they have some young guys that, you know, are going to have to step up. But, you know, based on the fact that they haven't, there's some people there who haven't played too much football, whether they're able to do that at a consistent basis and do it for the whole year, I think that'll be telling of really what Penn State's defense is able to do early in the year.
What are your expectations in terms of his ability and timeline of dominating, which is something you and I have talked about on here, is that even if Abdul Carter's playing well, sometimes it's not as visually striking as you might like it to be. Yeah. You think it's going to take some games before he maybe gets to that Micah Parsons level of holy crap, this guy's disrupting every play that opponents are running? Or what are your expectations for him for next season amid this transition?
My expectations are high because we've seen that he's capable of doing that. It's not like we didn't see that as freshman year. It's not like we didn't see that at portions throughout this past season. I think that as a defensive end now, as a primary disruptor, just the more opportunities he has to rush the pass and kind of flash on the tape, I think he will do it because we've seen that he's capable of doing it. You know, this is a very good football player. He's arguably, you know, maybe the most talented player on the entire roster, I think you could say. So for him to kind of get out of maybe those more pass coverage situations that linebackers sometimes have to drop back into and really just focus on rushing the passer and stopping the run, you know, I think he'll thrive in that role.
A point that came up frequently, and at least in the question side, I don't know if James Franklin was bringing up as much himself, was that Penn State is replacing three coordinators this offseason. I think you and I, you know, on this podcast, we're often talking about that, right? We're talking about Tom Allen, we're talking about Andy Kotelnicki, but I don't know that we've super talked about it as a holistic. Listen, Penn State's replacing all of their top coaches other than James Franklin. What's your sense of how that broad transition is going for this team and this program? You know, going to three new guys and who might like to do things differently than, you know, Manny Diaz, Mike Yurcich, the guys who preceded them.
Yeah, it's such a unique situation, right? To kind of clean house and, you know, have three new guys leading, you know, your three primary units is interesting. But, you know, when you walk in that building, it really doesn't feel like anything's changed. You know, I think it's an improvement on offense, obviously, because, you know, Mike Yurcich was fired midseason. So to bring someone in now that you know, this is a fresh new face with a fresh energy on offense, it feels good. You know, on defense, I think is where it gets a little interesting, where, you know, they had a guy in Manny Diaz that was well respected by every single player in that defense and very well respected by the entire coaching staff. So for that transition where you have a new guy in here when they were already comfortable with the old situation, you know, I think that'll be telling. But, you know, Tom Allen, from what we've heard from players and, you know, what we saw at practice yesterday, it feels like a clean transition. This isn't, you know, some random guy they found on the street. You know, this is a guy with, you know, 8 years of head coaching experience at the Big Ten level, you know, numerous coordinating jobs as well. And, you know, I think it should be a decent transition, especially just because, you know, Penn State's a good defensive school and it's not too much different of the defense that they had last year. Obviously some rotating pieces, but, you know, it should be all right.
Not a ton of continuity at those top coaching positions, Seth, but one thing James Franklin brought up, a reason he feels encouraged this season is that he feels that they've cultivated a lot of depth. I think he said 106 mm-hmm. players, something like that he feels good about. He also said he expects to have a more traditional spring game because you can field two solid teams to go against each other in a true blue-white game and maybe less of a practice exhibition that fans get to be in on. Is that something I think specifically that he should be commended for in this NIL age, when I think in a lot of programs, the expectation is chaos, right? Yeah. The expectation is you're going to have a lot of portal guys. You're going to have a lot of freshmen, that there's going to be a lot of roster turnover. I think something that James Franklin has done is, I don't know if Penn State's where a lot of people, including myself, would want them to be in terms of bringing in outside talent and adding to the mix. But it does seem like, you know, when we talk about re-recruiting rosters, that James Franklin has done probably one of the better jobs in college football, keeping his guys in place. What's your read on that?
I think you could make the argument that retaining your players is, you know, way more important than going out in the portal and bringing in new faces. Because we've seen, you know, countless examples across the country of teams who are maybe in a good position to compete, and then all of a sudden, you know, they lose a key player. You know, you look at Ole Miss, which, you know, after the Peach Bowl, I would have said, okay, well, this is a team that could potentially compete for a national championship next year. You know, they did well in the portal too, bringing in a lot of fresh faces, but then at the same time, they lose their star running back in Quinshon Judkins. For Penn State to be able to really not lose any key players, I think is pretty remarkable in this day and age. And, you know, to have a full roster right now, to be able to field, you know, multiple lines, you know, because I remember in 2021 or 2 years ago, you know, when they weren't able to do a real traditional spring game, you know, they couldn't even field two offensive lines. And for them to kind of have, I guess, sets now, and for them to be able to get a lot of these early enrollees on campus, I think it's pretty impressive. So, you know, it does say a lot about what Franklin's done and how he's kind of transitioned into this new era of college football. I think it's rare, and I think it's pretty impressive for sure.
Well, what's your read on that in the context of these Nick Saban comments that are going around? Yeah. Basically, Nick Saban's telling anyone who listens is he got out of the game because he feels the relationships have been reduced to, well, how much are you going to pay me? And maybe that's part of the success that Alabama has had for so many years, and that, you know, there's an expectation from the types of players that he's getting in there, which are very frequently NFL caliber players, guys who, you know, might have been able to just go directly into the draft if that was an option for them. Maybe the caliber of guys that Nick Saban's dealing with is a little bit different than what they are at Penn State, but it seems like that's not, it seems like the culture at Penn State is different, and that the guys are still looking at Penn State as a place that you can develop for the next level and not simply, you know, maximize earning power while in college.
Yeah. I mean, James Franklin's repeated that so many times of this is, you know, we're going to focus on developing our talent. We're not going to go out and, you know, forget about the high school recruiting sector and only focus on the transfer portal. We're going to keep doing it the traditional way, but we're also going to go out and, you know, and adapt to, you know, kind of the ways of college football now to be able to compete. And I do think they've been doing it the right way. I agree with you before when you said, you know, maybe they could be doing more with NIL and more to bring in, you know, some star power in the transfer portal. But I do think they're doing things relatively the right way, where when James Franklin sits down with a high school recruit, you know, he's telling them, like, you're not really promised anything here. Like, we'll help you out when it comes to NIL. Like, we're going to take care of our athletes. We hope you're able to start at some point, but we're not going to promise you anything. And that's the same thing when it comes to the transfer portal. That's just kind of the way he's done things and the way he set things up. And I don't think that's really changed from 2014 to now. It's just there are some other conversations that are included, which go, okay, well, we're going to have to help you out in some other areas as well. But I don't think anything is promised in football. And I don't think anything's promised under James Franklin's program as well.
One of the things that he also was asked about on Tuesday was the Pac-12 teams coming in. And he said, well, it's not going to be as different as I think some people seem to think it might be. He said that the offenses the Pac-12 teams are running are similar to what's in the Big Ten. That raised my eyebrow a little bit. I think even maybe on a schematic level, there are some similarities, Seth. But in terms of execution, I look at these Pac-12 programs as miles ahead of a lot of what Penn State sees in the Pac-12 or what the Pac-12 offense has been able to do. So what's your read on how different things are going to be, how big a part of Penn State's season that's coming up, you know, facing these teams is going to be? Because Penn State has the task of facing, I think, three of the four that are coming from the Pac-12, Washington, USC, and UCLA. Don't see Oregon. But arguably more than any other team in the Big Ten, Penn State is feeling the effects of Big Ten expansion.
Yeah, you can make the argument that maybe UCLA is right now similar to a Big Ten offense. But you look at USC and you look at Washington and Oregon, and it's just, I mean, it's way more explosive. That also, like, I lifted my eye as well. I'm like, what are you talking about? The defense is also very different. I think there's way more of a focus from these traditional Big Ten teams on that dynamic defense to kind of carry the weight. I do think that Ohio State in recent years is maybe the most similar to some of these Pac-12 offenses that are coming in. But it would be interesting to see to kind of how that balances out. I mean, you look back at the Rose Bowl in 2016 when Penn State played USC, and, you know, that's an example of maybe how Big Ten teams are going to have to evolve to keep up with the pace of some of these Pac-12 offenses, because they score, you know, they score a lot of points, and they're highly explosive, and they're not afraid to, you know, to pass the ball. I mean, that's another thing. We go back to Drew Aller not being afraid. You look at these Pac-12 quarterbacks, like, they're not afraid to throw the rock. You know, they're not afraid to throw it downfield often. So for him to kind of get out of his, you know, maybe comfort zone a little bit and start looking like a Pac-12 quarterback, we'll see how Penn State's maybe able to evolve. But I think they'll have to if they want to compete.
Yeah, I could see them getting into some I don't want to say track meets, but games where you're not going to be able to rely on the concept of, you know, I think back to that Indiana game. It was a shock that they scored that first touchdown. Right. Just the way Penn State's defense has been playing. I think you are going to see more of those games. And I think that goes back to conversations you and I have had, Seth, just about how the Peach Bowl kind of is how college football is played in a lot of different places. And that if Penn State's thrown into matchups like that, are they going to be able to react the same way that they would, you know, facing some of these Big Ten teams? I'm not sure. So I think this season's going to be very interesting in that regard, especially because it's going to be a quarter of Penn State's schedule is these Pac-12 teams. Fortunately, two of them are coming to Penn State, so you get to not have to deal with the logistics end, which is something James Franklin talked a little bit about as well. You're only going to have that one trip to the West Coast with USC. But listen, it's a big change for any team's schedule to have three new teams on a schedule that you very rarely see. Plus, you're going to have West Virginia, right? So it's just going to be a very, I think, interesting. How does Penn State attack this very diverse schedule next season? We have plenty of time to get into that. Seth, any other spring storylines you're watching here? I know you talked a little bit about the offensive line yesterday and about Saquon Barkley signing the big deal and some of those other Penn State free agents in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, there was a note on the offensive line with Drew Shelton, who is, you know, pretty highly touted, and he's played a lot of football over the past 2 years. He's going to be out for the spring with an injury. Franklin said he had surgery after the year. So, you know, it was kind of just one of those things where he was able to play through the injury late in the season. But once the year ended, you know, wanted to get things figured out. So he's done for the spring. And, you know, in his place, there are a number of young offensive linemen coming up. Like, the depth is still there, despite losing three starters, you know, on the offensive line. And there's no name that's popping off more than Cooper Cousins right now, you know, who is ranked, you know, number one interior offensive lineman in the country coming out of high school. And this is a guy I think has a pretty good shot to get good minutes at that center position, maybe even start. You know, competition's probably between him and Nick Dawkins right now. Dawk obviously has years of experience on him, but, you know, this is an 18-year-old kid supposed to be a senior in high school. He's 6'6", 319 pounds, and he looks good. Like, this is not a guy who looks too big. Like, he looks like he should. And I think there's a lot of people excited about what he can do, especially at that center position. You know, other than that, you mentioned Saquon Barkley. He's back in PA. You know, James talked about that and, you know, his impact and being able to bring him back to campus. I know Trace McSorley and Grant Haley are going to talk to the program. But, you know, pretty interesting. And I know he talked to Saquon a couple nights ago. And so, yeah.
I know our friends in the eastern part of the state are pretty fired up about the Saquon Barkley thing. I think it's landed with a little bit more of a thud for the Steelers-leaning community we have cultivated here on our Post-Gazette Sports Now YouTube channel. I know you're a Chicago guy, Seth, so I don't know if it's landing quite the same way with you and I, but I know it is a big deal for those of you who are listening to this east of the Delaware River. So congratulations on all your success, I suppose. Seth, I want to get into some hoops. Penn State plays Michigan tonight while we're recording this, 9 p.m. In that first round on Peacock. They're going to have to win at least two games to get to 500 and be eligible for the NIT. Do you think that they can do that? Do you see enough investment left at this late stage of the season that's something that's important to this program to maybe make another late season or, you know, Big Ten tournament run to kind of extend their year the way they did last season? Obviously, I think we think the NCAA tournament is pretty well out of the question. You're really just talking about the NIT, but there's still something to play for here.
Yeah, I mean, the bracket's certainly set up pretty well for them where, you know, they have Michigan, which will be tonight. So I guess when the podcast comes out, the game will already be over. But, you know, in Indiana, if they beat Michigan, which is a team Penn State's already beaten twice. So I think it's set up relatively well and to get two wins and maybe go to the NIT, but there's certainly something to play for. I think there are some years, maybe some programs where you go, oh, the NIT, you know, we don't care about that because we're only focused on the NCAA tournament. I think in the first year under a new head coach for a program that's typically struggled to get into the tournament, you know, I think getting the NIT would be a pretty big deal and would be a good way to end the year and kind of move things forward for the program. They also won the NIT a couple of years ago, so kind of seeing how that's able to propel a program. But yeah, I do think there's absolutely something to play for, which is kind of contrary to, you know, Michigan's situation where I think they just kind of want to roll over and end this season already.
Yeah, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on giving a grade for Mike Rhodes' debut season. There were some pretty big face plants. I think of those double collapses against Minnesota. I think of how they played in Florida. I think of what they lost to Bucknell. Some pretty bad losses, Seth, balanced with some huge wins. You upset Illinois at Rec Hall. You upset Wisconsin at home. The Big Ten record ended up being one of the better Big Ten records that this program's produced. Didn't do as well in the non-conference, so that doesn't really, you know, translate into the final record. But, you know, when you and I were talking before the season, I think we said, man, can they win 6 or 7 Big Ten games? I think they got, what, to 8? I think that was, you know, there's a lot of good, and I think there's a lot of bad. What grade do you give them, and how do you think that grade still has the ability to change if they can win a couple games here, get into the NIT, maybe, you know, get a little bit more good vibes going into next year?
Yeah, I'd honestly give them a B+. I think Mike Rhodes has done a great job here, especially when I've, you know, I covered the first year under Micah Shrewsbury too, which was a somewhat similar situation where, you know, mass exodus of players, got to bring in a bunch of new transfers, and it's hard to do. You know, it's hard to win with that model where you bring in a bunch of guys who have never played together, and just all of a sudden you're like, all right, let's figure it out and start winning games in the Big Ten. That is not easy. And like you said, you know, the Bucknell loss, ugly, you know, kind of blowing some leads against Minnesota, Northwestern, ugly. But at the same time, for you to kind of come out and get 2 top 15 wins, do it at some big stages too, to win at the Palestra, to kind of showcase the entire state, like, all right, you know, maybe we're able to do something here. I do think that this season should be considered a success. And I think Penn State basketball is trending in the right direction. They have a good recruiting class coming in. They're recruiting all over the country. I think Mike Rhodes was the right hire. You know, I don't think there's really any denying that at this point. And I think, you know, maybe you could make the argument too that maybe Micah Shrewsbury leaving, you know, was a silver lining. You know, maybe that's the direction this program needed, was to bring in an in-state guy who was just an ideal fit. But moving into Big Ten tournament, you know, this season is not done yet. I think they're still able to do some things. And at this point, I think I can confidently say, you know, this team could compete with any team in the Big Ten, with maybe the exception of Purdue.
Well, maybe it's a reason Penn State felt a little more comfortable than maybe everyone else did, looking at them losing Micah Shrewsbury after the success they had last season. I think the departure of Micah Shrewsbury is going to go down in athletic department lore is kind of when everyone woke up with this NIL and the new way of doing business. And it was almost kind of a necessary awakening for a lot of people that, hey, if Penn State doesn't have its ducks in a row, this good thing that just happened for the program can go downhill. And so I agree with you, Seth. I think, you know, they had a good guy on deck to kind of take over for Micah Shrewsbury. I think Micah Shrewsbury catalyzed some things. And I think Penn State a year later is in a lot better place than maybe it was even in the middle of this NCAA tournament run. And I'm not just talking about basketball. I think I'm talking about the athletic department as a whole. That said, Seth, I want to wrap up here, talk a little bit about the Lady Lions. Very much looks like their late season collapse is going to cost them an NCAA tournament bid by a couple of seed lines. I think last night, Charlie Cream of ESPN had them as the first two out, basically, of the NCAA tournament. They're obviously done in the Big Ten tournament. No ability to add to the resume between now and Selection Sunday. Where does this program stand in your mind after 5 years of Carolyn Keegar? She had some solid players this season. They had a lot of success, but ultimately fall short. I guess I asked that question specifically in the context of, listen, women's basketball TV ratings were roughly equivalent to men's games this season. I think the women's game is probably in a healthier place than men's right now. Women's basketball is a place of focus. Penn State is a traditional power in women's basketball. It's only in the last decade that things have kind of fallen off. What is the bar at Penn State right now, and what should the bar be in your mind?
I think the bar should be to make the NCAA tournament, especially when you bring in a transfer class like they did last offseason. You know, for this collapse, I mean, it's pretty embarrassing, honestly, where, you know, there was a point in the year where they were ranked and you're saying, okay, well, this is a lock. This team's a lock to make the NCAA tournament. They're one of the best teams in the conference, in a conference that, you know, is garnering a ton of views right now, you know, with Iowa and Caitlin Clark. So for them to kind of collapse the way they did, I think kind of says a lot about that coaching staff and, you know, moving forward, if they're able to kind of bring in the transfers and the recruits that they've kind of brought in, especially this past offseason, I think there's hope. But I think in a lot of ways, this was the year that maybe started the trajectory of, okay, we're going to bring Penn State women's basketball back. And they unfortunately, couldn't get it done.
Yeah, a bit of a fumble. And I think it was the way they collapsed too, Seth. I think of those two games against Iowa where you have all these eyes on you. You're kind of at the center of the college basketball world facing Caitlin Clark, and you didn't just not win. I think that'd be one thing. They didn't play well at all. And I think that was my biggest source of disappointment there was, on that stage, they didn't perform better.
Yeah, and that we saw that a couple games too, even outside of Iowa where there were some games that they looked great. This you're saying, okay, well, this is a team that should make the tournament, total contender. And then there are other games where they're, losing by like 30 points. What's going on here? And I just don't understand kind of how that happens where you kind of lack that consistency to at least compete. Not even necessarily win every game, but to just look competitive. That's important when you're trying to make the NCAA tournament.
Maybe you impress some recruits out there and say, hey, Penn State played a barn burner with Iowa. They lost, but listen, they gave Iowa all they could handle. Yeah. We didn't see that. So I'm going to be curious to see how things unfold with that program. I think they're on a lot more people's radar than they were maybe this time a year ago. And I think that might ramp up the pressure a little bit. It'll be curious to see how things go. But Seth, thanks for joining me. Back with a vengeance here on the Penn State Sports Podcast. We're going to be here at least weekly, I think, through the spring, talking about the storylines, reacting to what we see, what we hear over the next few weeks. So looking forward to kind of getting back in the swing of things, Seth.
Yep, absolutely.
Take care, everybody. Stay tuned. We will have a lot more the rest of the week. NFL free agency. I'll be back with Paul Zeiss on Thursday morning. If there's any news between now and then, we'll get into it. If not, we'll get Paul's takes on all that stuff. So make sure you subscribe. Make sure you like this video if you enjoyed it. Help us out in the YouTube algorithm, and we'll talk to you all again real soon.
Thank you for checking out this content from Post Gazette Sports. If you watch this video on YouTube, please like the video and subscribe to our channel. For all of the sports coverage the Post Gazette has to offer, visit post-gazette.com.